Good morning, everybody. Happy Monday, and welcome to episode 45 of the Bitcoin Veteran Spaces. I am your host, Coleman, and I see we have Terrence and Hunter on the panel. Good morning, gentlemen. I see we have Greg Foss, Joe Carlisari, DR Lewis, Wade Hoke, Death in Bitcoin, Allison, all in the audience. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Terrence, before we roll into things, would you mind giving us an update? We had Santa Monica Bitcoin peer-to-peer over the weekend. Do you mind telling us how that went?
Yeah, sure. It went well. I mean, it was part of a lot of different events that went on over a 4 or 5 day period, but we couldn't have been happier with the turnout. I don't know the exact numbers, but you know, it was a Friday. It wasn't even a weekend. It was pretty packed. There was a lot of good discussions. There were some good panels. We had lots of Bitcoin vendors out on the street, but it was generally really good. You just never know when you're going to be out in public, you know, who's going to come by. And it's like, especially in Santa Monica, where there is some, you know, homeless and mental illness, and you just don't know if someone's going to come down the street with a megaphone and start yelling that we're all scammers and criminals. But it was a really good vibe and a really good interaction with the public. I think most people, the good thing is I don't think anyone was like, what is Bitcoin? Everyone had heard of it. Many people owned some, but they weren't sure why. Of course, a lot of people owned crypto, so it seemed like the largest discussion tended to be the typical, you know, the difference between Bitcoin and crypto and how Bitcoin is different. But it was civil, it was fun, and a lot of Bitcoiners showed up, way, way more than I thought would, which was fantastic. I don't know anything specific I can say, just because it went well. It was uneventful, which was a positive thing.
Uneventful in a good way. I like that. I'm glad it went well. I know Dombey was really big in getting that going. Same with the other members at Swan. So I'm glad it was a good event to have. Good morning, Hunter. I see you out there. How was your weekend?
Hey, good morning, guys. What's going on? I had a good weekend. I hosted my first Bitcoin meetup on Friday night, so that was kind of cool. It's funny that Terrence was talking about a homeless person calling them scammers, because I had actually promoted my meetup on my local county Facebook group, and man, they dogpiled me on there, calling me a scammer. And I was just trying to, you know, encourage them to come in and see for yourself. I'm not asking for any money. It's just for to educate the public. But it was really interesting to kind of take the temperature on my local small country town in Northeast Georgia. Their exposure to Bitcoin is purely limited to criminals and scamming. And but you know, the meetup went well, and I think I changed some minds, and I think it's going to grow to the next meeting. We should have even more people there. So all in all, it was a success, and just proved to me there's a lot of work to do here in rural Georgia to Orangeville people.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad you had a good event. But for anybody that's doubting, I would just point them to that new ECB article that they released and just let them know that even the ECB agrees that if you're late to the game, you're going to become poorer because Bitcoin is life raft. I'm not sure if anyone saw that article or knows what I'm referencing, but we'll definitely dive into that today. But before we get too much further, I just want to make sure everyone understands the reason why we're doing this and the reason we do this Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. And it's to show what we can do as a group with this decentralized network and with Bitcoin. We're out there right now still helping the victims and families of Hurricane Helene with Operation Gabriel. We still have, I believe, Shane Hazel, Jordan, and Mike on the ground taking care of everybody that's still affected. And so I know that all of us, myself included, have a really short attention span. And it's been about three weeks since that hurricane hit. And so they're starting to shift a lot of focus from that storm and that event, but the people there are still living it in real time. And it's really tragic. It's starting to become colder. A lot of people still don't have any power. Their livestock don't have any feed because the storm went through and just took away everything. So we still need a lot of help. I want to give a huge thank you, though, to everybody. We've raised over $115,000 in this effort. And so we're using those funds to make sure that we can get cold weather supplies, generators, fuel, and now farm feed to everybody that needs it. So again, we're going to keep touching on this. Hunter was actually out there last week and the weekend before. And so we're slowly starting to get people back to what we would call a normal life. And there's more videos that are starting to trickle through from firsthand accounts during the storm. But it's, I can honestly say that I'm really proud of the work that we're doing out there. Again, just being a part of this group, it's so amazing to see what we can do. And we're showing the world what Bitcoiners and decentralized technology can do. We don't need to have the government directly involved. We're becoming more effective, and we're making a greater impact than any government organization. So that's the reason I do this every day, and make sure that we can get this message spread out, and make sure everybody understands that this power is unstoppable, regardless of what some talking heads may say to try and question it. But I know we have Foss and Joe in the audience. I see Tomer out there. Good morning, sir. If you guys want to join up here and join this discussion, I want to go ahead and dive in. We'll start off with the Federal Reserve of Minnesota and the ECB. They both kind of released back-to-back statements over the weekend. And so I'd like to get everybody's thoughts and what they think that they're trying to project with those articles. And so in case y'all aren't familiar, let me pull up the article right here. The paper from the ECB states that early Bitcoin adopters steal economic value from the latecomers. They believe that Bitcoin, the price is going to continue to rise, and everybody who's coming in later will be left behind. But if you don't follow Tour de Meister, he posted a really good thread that I'll post into the nest. And he really thinks that this is a declaration of war from the ECB. And he believes that the authorities will use this argument to enact harsh tax and bans on Bitcoin and only have it as a centralized way. So I'd like to hear Foss, Terrence, Lawrence, I see you're here. Good morning, sir. But I'd like to get your thoughts. If someone just said something, I didn't hear you.
Hey, Coleman, it's Foss. I see Larry's here, so I'm not going to steal his thunder. I know when I say steal his thunder, I know you had invited him as a guest. So I'll just say it was an interesting weekend. I encourage people to keep an open mind with all the reports, the ECB report, Reserve of Minnesota report, Saylor's interview, you know, where he calls out crypto anarchists, I think, and I'm not defending Saylor here. I disagree with him on that front, but doesn't mean we always have to agree. But remember that he's the CEO of a publicly traded company. That may explain his response as much as anything, okay? So, Larry, please come up here and hi, Joe. Over to you guys.
Yeah, so thanks for having me on. You know, in reaction to the ECB was hysterical, right? I mean, Bitcoin's worthless, but by the way, it's distributed unfairly. Okay, which is it? Does it have value and therefore we care about how it's distributed, or is it truly worthless, as we've been saying all along? And then the Minneapolis Fed, I mean, that was kind of stunning. When I woke up and read Lynn's tweet this morning, you know, hey, guys, you're not supposed to say this stuff. I mean, I've long thought that this is, you know, one of the potential risks. And it's hard to assess the right probability to, you know, what these guys are going to do. But, I mean, there's always the possibility that as their fiat system fails, they're going to try and blame us being sound money people. And, you know, they could come after us in a bunch of ways. I mean, Roosevelt did it. You know, the modern version might be very high tax rates, you know, 70% tax on capital gains on gold, silver, and Bitcoin, or even confiscation. I mean, you know, if you want to be conspiratorial about it, you know, they set up the ETFs because it's going to be really easy for the federal government to say, hey, guess what, Fidelity, all that Bitcoin, that's ours. Cash everybody out, just give them paper, give them dollars equal to today's value. You know, I tweeted about this morning as well. You can go to my thread and see it. I mean, this is existential for them. I mean, we're playing for all the marbles here, and we've known this for some time, but what I think's going on is the other side's figuring it out.
Yes, in your tweet, Larry, you said that they're scared. The reason for all this is that they can see the writing on the wall. And I agree 100% with you. And I think the timing of both of those articles is not really a coincidence.
Yeah, I mean, we're up at the high end of the range on Bitcoin, but it really hasn't broken out yet. It's about to, and it's going to go to 200 grand, in my opinion, but quickly. But gold and silver, you know, have got to be scaring the shit out of them. I mean, they're just kind of relentlessly marching higher. I mean, with very shallow, if almost no pullbacks. So, you know, that's gold and silver are certainly sniffing a problem. And I think there are problems, big problems, and they're going to have to print to address the problems. And that's what the metals have figured out. And this is the way it always goes. The metals go first, Bitcoin goes second, Bitcoin goes much harder and faster. So it's coming.
So can I pick your brain, Larry, for a little bit? Why are the interest rates on the 10-year and the 30-year rising so steadily as well? Like, how is this all connected?
Well, as you know, Druckenmiller just announced he's short the 10-year in a big way. I mean, that, you know, look, some of it's just a bear steepener, but it's also a case of, you know, just do you want to hold debt with more than a few years duration in a country that's kind of bordering on the edge of being bankrupt, if not arguably truly bankrupt? And so, you know, it's interesting that he cut, you know, the short-term rates and made the short money cheaper, but the long money got more dear. And I you know, it's all of one thing, which is to say, I think there's an awareness starting to take place that there's no way out. They can't get out without printing more money. And that's coming, and gold smells it. You know, I think a lot of the 10-year holders probably smell it as well, and that's why it's going higher. On the other hand, I think there's a chance. I mean, the 10-year I don't trust quite as much, because I listen to David Hunter, and I think he's pretty good on a lot of markets. And his view is that, you know, we're gonna kind of ramp up into a much higher level on a lot of things in the later part of this year, early quarter next year, and then the economy is going to start to really have problems. And when that's the case, the 10-year is going to find a bid, and that does seem possible to me. So I'm not sure I trust the 10. He thinks the 10-year moving up the way it is a counter trend move in a longer term secular move down, not because inflation's going away, but more because the economy is really starting to sputter. And if you listen to David Rosenberg and some of the other good economists, they kind of come to the same conclusion. There's a lot of evidence that the economy is not as healthy as people, you know, certainly as the stock market has been behaving. I mean, the stock market is just, it's so detached from reality. It just blows my mind. I mean, go to John Hussman's site. Look at the statistics there. I mean, look, I get it. This is a new and different time than in the past. But, you know, this thing is so far such an outlier in terms of valuation that it's beyond extreme. And you know, that maybe they can keep that going. But the only way they can keep that going is if they print a ton of money, because there's no underlying value there. And without creating a ton of money to support it, on a go forward basis, that thing, it's going to collapse here at some point, in my opinion. The thing that makes it so tough, Coleman, is that just the variability and the lags on everything. I mean, it's, you know, like they increase the rates and it takes a while for it to filter through, you know, and then now they're cutting the rates, but that'll take a while to filter through too. And so, you know, there are a lot of moving pieces. It's hard to sort it all out, but, and it's all just probabilities, but you know, I think my model is we're gonna ramp up for another couple of months in the stock market, then it's gonna be, this is contrarian's view as well, David Hunter's view, then the market's gonna start to sputter, you know, we're gonna roll over and we're gonna have one hell of a bust, and at that point Jay Powell's gonna be forced into, he's gonna be the deer in the headlights. I mean, he's gonna realize that he was too late in raising, then he raised too far. I mean, part of the reason why, you know, overall rates are coming down is they're just following, you know, he has to bring rates down because he's just following the market. I mean, the market for the 2-year was down quite substantially, and therefore he has to follow it. So it's, you know, it's confusing. There are a lot of moving pieces, but I don't think it ends well for stock people. I don't think it ends well for, you know, in a longer run for bond people. And I think in the shorter run, the only, you know, comfortable long bets that I have, and I think everybody has to have, and I'm writing a book about this, is, you know, sound money bets, which are, you know, gold, silver, and Bitcoin.
All right, I have a ton of follow-up questions from that, but I just want to give a quick shout-out and welcome to Tomer Strohlite and Sam Callahan. And Sam, I just want to say congratulations on your newly on your new marriage.
Oh, thank you. Appreciate it. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Good morning. Sam, I've been married for 15 years with my wife, and some of the best marriage advice I ever got that I try and impart on everybody is your marriage should be 90% laughter and 10% work, but that 10% work should take 110% effort. So Lauren,
sound advice.
Yeah, my only, I've been married for 33 years. My only piece of advice, Sam, is she's always right. Just if you live by that, you're going to be fine.
Yeah, I'm learning that. Well, we're going on our honeymoon soon, and she's like, I need a book, and she's taking The Creature from Jekyll Island. So I was like, I got a good one.
Yeah, you definitely you got a good one there. I'm really happy for you guys. You all should check out, you should clear calendars for the start of July, Bitcoin Alaska, July 5th and 6th. It'll be an awesome time.
Can we dig into this paper a little bit, though, a little bit more?
Yeah, definitely.
I thought it was one of the funniest and just most ludicrous papers I've ever read on Bitcoin. Like, it is ridiculous. It's hard. Like, I was talking to Alan Farrington about this in the DMs because I'm almost trying to write a rebuttal to it. And it's like Brandolini's Law, its finest, where it's just the bullshit. The amount of time I have to take to try to refute all this bullshit, I mean, it's ridiculous. I don't even know where to start. But I think one of the most ridiculous assumptions in the piece is that, you know, Bitcoin and, you know, price appreciation won't create any kind of productive potential for the economy. Like, it won't increase, you know, productivity at all. And for me, that's like a complete misunderstanding of what Bitcoin is in terms of saving versus investing. And basically, that's making the argument that saving doesn't promote any kind of productivity gains. And to me, savings is what leads to investment in real businesses and infrastructure. And to say that, like, saving in Bitcoin doesn't lead to any kind of productivity is just completely nonsensical to me. And the entire paper is basically based off that, saying that, you know, early adopters of Bitcoin, you know, will extract wealth from latecomers or non-holders because these early, you know, adopters will gain in so much wealth from the price appreciation, and they won't, you know, they'll just steal real assets, is what they call it, like Lambos, even say Lambos, Rolexes, real estate, because of this price appreciation. And that's just a complete misunderstanding of basically what Bitcoin is and what money is and how savings actually leads to productivity increases. And so that's just one point I had to hit home because it's so important, and it's just the most ridiculous thing I've ever read, I think. But to come from these central bankers who really have fiat brain, if you go to one of the author's Twitter profiles, in his image, like the picture above his profile, he literally has pictures of brains with different fiat currencies. He has fiat brain. It's ridiculous. So anyway, I'll open it up with that.
Anybody up here want to comment on that?
I mean, I would just kind of elaborate a little bit on the point using concrete examples. It's like, if you buy a Lambo with your Bitcoin, you've spent your Bitcoin, you're not hoarding it. If you invest in a business with your Bitcoin, then obviously you're doing something productive with it. But even if you save it and store it, you're causing the rest of the Bitcoin to be more valuable for people who choose to either spend it or further invest it. So the idea that deferring spending or investing is bad for the economy and bad for equality is, it really shows a complete lack of connecting what goes on with money to what goes on with the economy. It's this economist bubble that they put their heads into, where there's no outside events, there's no second order effects of what's going on. And I think it's really the biggest problem with all of this economic theory that that has not worked according to theory since Keynes published it. And we're all living with the consequences of it, but they choose to believe it because they've got equations and it's convenient for them, I guess, because it puts them in charge of everything and justifies them staying in charge. But Sam's completely right. I just thought, you know, giving an example of what goes on here. I've had these debates with these people in person in the past where they say, oh, if you save your Bitcoin, you're not doing anything good with it. And it's like, well, I'm not benefiting myself by saving it either until it comes time to spending it. So I'm low time preference. I'm deferring my expenditure so that other people can consume the other present resources of society. So I am making a trade-off. I am making a sacrifice in saving Bitcoin. And I'm doing it because I think it benefits me, but it also has an externality as a benefit. And also, it's not my duty. It's not my obligation to benefit other people at my own expense, right? Like if we all take care of ourselves, we end up with a better civilization than a civilization which nobody takes care of themselves and goes around playing a victim and begging everybody else to take care of them. So we do a better job of taking care of each other when we first take care of ourselves. Kind of leave it there because I don't
want they confuse topic. Yeah, that was well said, Tomer. It's like they confuse equal opportunity and equal outcome. It's like, yeah, equal opportunity is noble and ethical, and that's great. And that's one thing we love about Bitcoin, but it doesn't mean the outcome has to be equal. It, you know, otherwise we're just, it's like printing choices or printing sacrifices. It's like the choices and the work that one person does, you know, just sort of gets debased and devalued because of someone else. It's, they think Bitcoin, you know, will ruin or remove democracy, but that is the very definition of what we're doing with Bitcoin. We are voting. We are making our own vote. We're being democratic in the most pure way possible with Bitcoin. So yeah, it's hard to read the paper because it fails in just every sentence practically. Nothing makes sense to me.
Do you all think the timing of these two articles is just coincidence, or do you think it was planned? Anybody? Do you think? Because they almost paired the same things.
They're saying the same things. It could be. I doubt these people are coordinating too heavily. So I don't think it really matters if it's coincidence or not. I don't think that there's anything imminent about to happen.
I don't know. I think it's probably coincidence that they published around the same time. Maybe not. Who knows? But I just think like the hypocrisy throughout it is another thing that I think was really wild in terms of the ECB piece. I mean, you know, I think they're probably doing this intentionally, but this, you know, the fact that they are talking about wealth redistribution occurring and then they don't look in the mirror and look at their easy monetary policy since the global financial crisis, quantitative easing, ultra low interest rates. I mean, the ECB was running negative interest rates for a long time. You know, what was their role in increasing wealth inequality and their policies? It's just kind of ridiculous to see them write this and then say, hey, you know, Bitcoin's actually going to be the cause of inflation. And Bitcoiners have said this for many years, like Bitcoin will eventually get blamed for the inflationary policies of these central banks. And I think this is kind of in writing. We kind of see this narrative start to creep up, this messaging start to creep up, because they're recognizing the fact that Bitcoin's not going away. They can't just get away with saying that it's a bubble anymore because it's been 15, going on 16 years of it surviving and thriving and being adopted at an increasingly rapid pace. And now it's getting more serious because we have nation states, we have large investment firms, big time investors starting to get behind Bitcoin as real technology and as a new form of money. And I think they're starting to get scared.
You know, Sam, I think just a small correction. They have been very effective at making many people equally poor. At the ECB, they haven't managed to get it to the elites, but
Europeans are much poorer than when the euro came in and the ECB was created. So give them credit for what they've accomplished.
Joe, I see you have your hand up, sir. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. So fascinating conversation. I just a couple points about the ECB and the Fed in general. First off, these institutions are, the way to think about it is like they're a university, right? They've got hundreds of academics and economists, some full-time positions, some part-time positions, some that come and go, move into the public sector, move back to the private sector, and they all have different views. And they all argue about things, right? Now, the dominant view among both the Fed and the ECB is neo-Keynesian, and that is correct. But there's wide arrays of disagreement at all these different institutions. And if you, you know, we were talking about this recent piece, and people keep characterizing it as the ECB piece. I don't think that's really fair and accurate, as it is published by two primary authors, economists, who have published things that have been in direct contravention with things like that Lagarde has said in the past. There's sort of minority voices at the ECB. You know, for example, they were arguing for raising rates back in 2013, 2014, when rates were rock bottom throughout the ECB. And, you know, they were basically pushed to the corner and said, you know, go stare at the wall. So you know, when people say this is an ECB paper, it is true that ECB economists or ECB affiliated economists who are also tenured professors wrote the paper. But the paper itself expressly says these are not necessarily the views of the ECB as a whole. And by the way, the ECB has written in the past, people forget now, favorable things about Bitcoin. And we could pull up some of those papers as well. But you know, the voices at a large institution with hundreds of economists are going to disagree. They're going to argue things. And sometimes you know, people get a lot of traction for writing outlandish things that are not necessarily the views of the consensus view at the institution. So all of that to say, it's somewhat of a stretch to say because two, you know, minority economists at the ECB wrote a paper that the ECB has declared a war. The ECB as an institution has declared a war on Bitcoin. That is again hyperbole at its finest in full display on Twitter.
I know what you're saying, Joe, and I hear that, but I've actually been tracking the ECB since. I mean, I basically read everything they put out on the Bitcoin since 2016, I would say. And it's generally, they have never, I mean, there's been a couple papers where they've spoken kind of neutrally about Bitcoin. There's one called the Holy Grail of Payments where they talk about Bitcoin. But in general, every single blog post that I've come across, most of them by Fabio Panetta, which is a high ranking ECB official.
Correct.
He's a pushing, big deal. Yeah. Pushing the digital euro, and almost every single blog post that he's written has been negative, calling Bitcoin a Ponzi scheme, calling Bitcoin a currency of crime, you know, pretty much every single a polluter of the environment. They've basically been pushing anti-Bitcoin rhetoric for years, probably more than any central bank.
But most economists are anti-Bitcoin, like most traditional economists.
Yeah, but ECB, I'm telling you, the ECB specifically has been very anti-Bitcoin, I would say, compared to the Bank of England, Bank of Canada, the Fed. ECB has been number one.
For sure. I don't dispute that at all. But Beansale's paper, okay, the recent one, like for people to say that his views here on this are the views of the ECB as a whole, I think it's just incorrect. Now you can say, you know, that central bankers as a whole are hostile. I mean, Neil Kashkari comes out all the time and talks about how he thinks Bitcoin's worthless. It's, you know, speculative. It doesn't provide any value or utility. It doesn't have a use case. I mean, that's fine. I'll stipulate to that fully. But like for people to take one paper and say like, oh, this is a declaration of war by one guy. I mean, like, that's just like, you know, if you're in academia and you're an economist, you can develop my wife does this with the American Medical Association. You can develop papers with big institutions and you can publish. And they have to always include, like, this isn't our view as an institution. It's just my view as the principal author on the paper.
Yeah, I hear that.
All right, guys, I'm going to start rolling back. Larry's our featured guest today, so I wanted to pick his brain a little bit more. But I really appreciate the discussion. We're going really good. BJ Dichter, I see that you have your hand up. Do you have a question on this, or do you have something else, sir?
Yeah, I just want to add to what Joe was saying very quickly. which I generally happen to agree with, and I am no lover of central banks, but as none of us are. But, you know, a number of years ago, I was working with somebody, or was working for me, who had worked for the ECB. And we had talked about Bitcoin extensively as I was trying to orange-pill him over time. And he knew some of the most senior people at the ECB and explained to me, like, it's all divided. He said, they know exactly what Bitcoin is and what it could be. And I remember asking him, so where are they? Are they pro it? Are they against it? He said, they don't really know. He said, the person I know is actually on board with it. But some of the other people are extremely hostile. So again, it's just, it's a dysfunctional bureaucracy, like all large bureaucracies. And there's a lot of push and pull that goes on from the inside that we don't see, which is probably why some of these people kind of shoot from the hip and try to get their papers out and get the impression that the ECB is completely on board with it. But sometimes that's the complete opposite of the case, at least from my experience.
Thank you for that. So Larry, we'd mentioned, we were talking about yields rising, and you'd said that you think the economy is start to crater. I think you said in the second half or early midway of 25. Do you buy into stock with the there's two economies going on? There's the top tier and then the bottom tier. And the reason I bring that up is because when I go out to restaurants, it depending on what part of town I go into, the restaurants are really full or the restaurants are extremely empty. And it looks like they're really hurting for business. So I'd like to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, there clearly is a two-tier economy. I mean, you've got, you know, boomers, you know, who've saved up most of their life and have had the benefit of appreciating real estate and everything else are in a lot better shape than, you know, millennials. And, you know, you see that. And so, you know, the economy is not falling apart. I mean, the aircraft, you know, the TSA data, I mean, people are still taking flights, they're taking trips. I mean, as Grohman points out, it's a big YOLO with all the boomers when they, you know, had COVID come around, realized they may not be around as long as they thought. They're spending down their accumulated savings. But I think beneath it all, there's a lot of evidence that things are really slowing down. I mean, the SOM rule got triggered, you know, unemployment is going up. You're starting to see big layoffs. I mean, Boeing 17,000. And probably more importantly, you're seeing the squeeze. I mean, you've got, you know, labor pushing for very big hikes. I mean, the Longshore Union, you know, was able to get well over 6% a year for a number of years, and that's not 2%. And so, you know, I think what you've got coming on is kind of a squeeze, you know, and yeah, it is a two-tier economy. I mean, people in the upper income levels are okay. I mean, they're not, I don't think they're great. The cost of everything they do is going up. I know, you know, my insurance is a big one for me anyway. Home insurance and auto insurance, I'm just blown away. I mean, there's no way that's close to 2%. But, you know, it's mixed, but you're starting to see credit card delinquencies. I mean, these are all small early warnings. I mean, it's not as if we've got an economic apocalypse coming in the basic economy, but remember that the stock market is priced for perfection and a soft landing. And it appears to me that I think a soft landing is a fantasy. I don't think that's going to happen. I think we're going to have, things are going to slow down. And as they do slow down, the stock market is going to have to adjust. You know, the stock market to me, I mean, you know, having been through a bunch of market cycles, I can just say with high, you know, probability, I mean, nobody since 2008 has really seen a bear market. I mean, a serious long-term bear market. I mean, this has been one long case of buy the dip and it's always worked out. You know, we've gone on to new highs and, you know, I'm here to say that I think bear markets can still exist. And at some point one will exist in the United States. I'm not sure when it's going to start. But, you know, I would say probably next year is as good a candidate as any other time, based on kind of what I see.
A quick question for you. I don't know the answer to it, and I'm hoping you do. How do the insurance companies get out of this, the issue that they have, where it's just becoming unrealistic for them to be able to insure everybody with the amount of damages that are going on?
Well, it's twofold. It's not just the damages from the storms. It's also the hits they've taken on their bond portfolio. I mean, I've talked to some friends in the insurance industry and they're like, hey, look, you know, our balance sheets took a huge hit because we had a lot of long duration stuff at low numbers and those numbers have gotten higher. And, you know, so Yeah, the insurance business is a tough business, and but they, you know, they pass it along, right? I mean, that's how, you know, my homeowner's insurance went up 100% year over year. I mean, I was shocked. So it, yeah, it's, you know, look, I mean, and what it's going to lead to, I think, I know in my category, I'm even thinking about it, is just people will self-insure and they'll just say to heck with it. You know, I mean, my house burns down, I'll be able to figure out a way to rebuild it. I'm not paying this, you know, crazy amount of money to protect against something that's a very low odd event, you know?
Yes, but that would be only an option for people who have their house paid off, correct? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, that's right. No, that's exactly right. If you've got a note against your house, you've got a, yeah, you can't, they won't let you go without insurance. You're correct.
So how do first-time homeowners that move to Florida, how are they going to be able to afford this?
they're not. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, how are my 20-year-old kids going to be able to afford housing? I mean, they're all doing fine, but, you know, they don't have a prayer of buying housing at the levels they're at, you know, and of course, in the cities they live in a, two of them live in New York. So it's nuts. It's just nuts, which is really why we need the system to implode, which it is, and we need to reset so that we get back to some semblance of a fair system with fair pricing. I mean, you know, houses have got a big fiat premium in them, in my opinion, based on BlackRock buying a bunch of them and just based on a lot of people viewing that as a decent store of value. And, you know, it is a store of value because you can't print a house, but, you know, the taxes, the maintenance, everything else, I think people are going to realize that there are much other stores of value. There are much better forms for store of value than a house, you know.
Absolutely. And I think you're right. There has to be a reset. Things are just becoming more chaotic and it's just, it's really, we live in a really weird time. And I know you believe in the fourth turning. You believe in that. And I feel the same way. I think we're coming onto something. The end of something, whatever that is, I don't know. But things definitely have to change.
Yeah. I mean, I listened to Lynn recently and she said, you know, she thinks there's a few more swings in it. I think that's probably right. I mean, I kind of mark, I think this whole thing will get wrapped up in the early 2030s, you know, and that we'll have a couple more big wide swings, which is really going to be hellish for everybody just because, you know, there's a lot of volatility when you're going through the kind of changes that we're going through right now. I mean, you know, we've all seen the Dan Oliver Weimar chart, you know, describing what happened in Weimar, Germany in 20 to 23. And, you know, I mean, I think gold, silver, and Bitcoin could rip up to a couple hundred thousand, you know, I mean, in the case of Bitcoin, a couple hundred thousand this year, then the economy could roll over, the stock market could blow up, the Fed will be behind the curve again, they won't print quickly enough. And, you know, we could see a 50% correction in all of those assets as everyone scrambles for liquidity. And then, of course, the Fed reacts to that and says, all right, you know, we're not going to let prices go down. You know, deflation can't happen here. And, you know, they take their balance sheet to $20 trillion, which, you know, that's probably what happens next. I mean, it's you know, it's a ways out there. And, of course, once again, they're behind the curve. They probably don't print enough fast enough. But then when they do get to it, they print too much. So, I mean, we've got these big fugoid swings of, you know, of activity based on a Federal Reserve that it just doesn't know what the fuck they're doing. I mean, it's just... You know, my book describes this. I mean, this is not new. It's been going on since 1913. And, you know, it's there are plenty of examples of how the Fed makes the situation worse. You know, if we had a sound money, if we had a sound money system, you know, the economic ups and downs would not be as bad. Everyone claims, you know, the people who started the Fed claimed that the 1880s and 1890s were a terrible time because there were a couple of panics. But in general, you know, it was a deflationary environment and real income grew and GDP grew. So, you know, they're wrong to suggest that things were worse before, you know, and that we had to have a Fed. They were wrong. We do not need a Fed. The Fed should be gone, you know, and we should, you know, we should all operate on a sound money standard. And everyone should have the choice of whatever money they want to use. I mean, there should be no taxes on gold, silver, and Bitcoin. And, you know, and on dollars, I mean, just as there aren't, you know, it's legal tender today and people can choose whichever one of those they want. I think once they start, I mean, that's the policy proposal in my book. I think once we get there, you know, it'll become pretty obvious to people what the best place to store for savings is. I mean, it's going to take a while until it's a means of exchange. This is Bitcoin, you know, because the Lightning Network needs a lot of work. But you know, I think it will become a means of exchange. I just don't think that's going to happen as quickly as any of us would like. So,
Thank you for that. And I agree. I don't think there should be any intervention, regardless of if you're trying to do good or ill. There's always going to be negative consequences to one side of the party. So I think the market should just figure it out itself. And you're right, there shouldn't be a Federal Reserve. But I have a question for you. I just posted it up in the Nest. I saw this over the weekend, and I have no idea what it means. It looks horrible, but nothing's happening. So unrealized losses at the U.S. banks are now 7 times higher than that during the 2008 financial crisis. So if you don't mind, Larry, could you kind of...
Yeah, I'm familiar with that chart. I mean, it's, and this is where, you know, they the held to maturity category. I mean, you know, everyone says they bailed out the banks in 2008 and 2009, and they did. But the thing that they really did was when they changed FASB 157 and allowed banks to mark to myth, that's what ended it. And of course that law is stuck around. And so, yeah, these banks can have enormous unrecognized losses if you marked all their assets to market, and they claim, well, but we're going to hold them to maturity, so it doesn't matter. So we're marking it to a model, and we believe in the model, and therefore we don't have to take them today. Fine. Except that, you know, as things come due, particularly in the commercial real estate area, you can run into trouble. And so, you know, Bank of America is one that's been rumored to be in serious trouble. That they've got a huge number in that category, like something over $100 billion was what I read. And, you know, that's, these things will surface. I mean, but again, you know, they all have swap lines, they all have funding from the Fed, they all have reserve accounts. I mean, it's, you know, where's the trigger event? Where's the pain? I mean, they can continue to kick this can for quite some time because they've kicked it this far. So who's to say they can't kick it further? Do you know what I mean? But at some point in time, something could break. And I do believe over some period of time, something will break. I mean, I just don't know when it will break. That's the tricky part. You know, we mathematically know that if they do not grow the base money and they do not grow the credit structure, you know, the existing structure will topple on itself because, you know, it's a, I mean, the Keynesian lie is very clear. You know, that you've got to continue to grow the money supply and credit, or else it all implodes. I mean, this is, you know, von Mises pointed this out to us. And so, you know, that's the issue, and it's going to come to a head. We just don't know when. But it feels to me like it's probably, there's going to be a lot of turmoil in the next year or so. And the metals are telling you that the metals smell it. You know, the gold and silver price behavior says we figure this out. We know what's coming next. And that's why they're doing what they're doing. And the great news is, I mean, I know some Bitcoiners are frustrated, like, well, hey, how come these metals are moving? We're not moving. Well, this is the way it was last time, too. And what will happen is Bitcoin's going to come along. It's going to blow past the metals. I mean, it's, you know, gold's up 30%. That's great. And it'll probably be up 40 or 50% next year. Bitcoin's going to go up 200% in the next 2 years, in my view. So, but it's just the nature of the way it trades. It takes a while. So,
okay. Thank you. And thank you for explaining that. There's another thing I'd like to get into. And I guess it's just more speculation, than anything, but the Treasury report was supposed to come out, last week, and there's been radio silence. Can you?
No, it came out. It came out late Friday. You got to look at it. And they actually ran, they didn't run a deficit. They actually ran a surplus. Yeah, no, I actually, in my quarterly newsletter, I wrote something about this. This is kind of suspicious. And that was my conspiracy side coming through. And I was wrong. You know, they reported it. If you go to the site, you can see it now. And I mean, what's weird, though, I mean, set that aside for a minute. The flip of that is, you know, the deficit, they're now saying the deficit for the fiscal year ended September was $1.8 trillion. If you look at the same time period, the debt actually went up by 2.2 or 3. So I'm just kind of, I mean, it's funny accounting. I'm just kind of thinking, okay, if your deficit's 1.8, but your debt increased by 2.3, where's the other half a billion that, you know, we didn't, or half a trillion that we're, you know, it's not, how do we miss that? You know what I mean? I don't know. So maybe somebody who's smarter than me can explain that to me. But, you know, look, they've got a real problem. You know, there's absolutely no will and no discipline in Washington, D.C. to rein this stuff in. And sadly, I mean, I think they're going to run you know, it's Lynn's point that nothing's going to stop this train. They're going to run the train right over the edge. And, you know, then we're going to have a hell of a mess. And, you know, hopefully then we'll have some politicians who are smart enough to realize that the sound money was the issue and take us back towards a sound money system. You know, I don't know how to handicap that, but because you know there'll probably be a lot of socialist politicians who will think no, the right solution is to put Stephanie Kelton in here and you know print a ton of money. So I don't know. It's a mess. But guys, I got to run because I got another meeting I got to go into. But it's been very nice being with you. I love the veterans, love everybody on this call, and you know, good luck to folks. I mean, I think you know it's going to be an interesting couple of months here, and I think that our assets are going to perform extraordinarily well for the next 6 months. So we can take some comfort in that. You know, what the world's going to look like? Yeah, that may not be so good. We'll see. And I would just say I'm writing a book. It'll be out at the end of the year, and I hope you know if you've got interest in this stuff, you pick it up. It won't be too expensive. It's a trade paperback, so I'll put in my plug for that.
Well, thank you so much, Larry. And I was very happy that you're able to join us this morning. And just a reminder, I don't know if you've heard, we're going to have a Bitcoin conference in Juneau, Alaska next July, the beginning of it. So if you've never been to Juneau or Alaska, it's amazing in the summer. We'd love to have you come.
Well, it sounds interesting, and I'll definitely put it down as a possibility. I wanted to do that cruise from Vancouver up to Alaska for a long time, so it makes sense to do that in front of the conference. So I will think about it. But thanks for the invite, and again, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it, and I'll see you all soon. Take care.
Thank you, sir. Well, we still have everyone's attention. I just want to give a quick thank you to our partners, Paladin Tower Tactics, professional firearms training at paladintowertactics.com. Black Sheep Ammo, restock your ammo at blacksheepammo.com. Punch Plate, I see all in the audience. Stamp your seed phrase on a metal plate at punchplate.com. And Solo Satoshi, open source Bitcoin mining at solosatoshi.com. Man, I just want to say we had an amazing panel up here today. I want to thank everybody who's tuning in. It was a lot of fun so far. Terrence, BJ, do you guys want to dive into anything that anybody talked about this morning?
I'm good so far. I'd say keep moving, Coleman.
Okay. Yeah, definitely. We'll keep rolling into it. But it's something that, we might not have enough time to cover everything. But Saylor did the part two of his interview, and it's getting a lot of heat, on social media. He's calling everybody who wants to hold their Bitcoin in their own self-hosted wallet, a paranoid crypto anarchist. And I know that a lot of people took that as an attack. And I have some mixed feelings about what he had said during the interview. We had a clip, but I'm not able to play it this morning, so I do apologize. But the reason I think he's hesitant on saying that you should host your own Bitcoin, I think he got a tap on the shoulder from the government. And this is just me. There's no evidence to support this. But he owns a lot of Bitcoin. And I think he got a tap saying, if you want to play this game and continue doing what you want to do, you need to play by our rules. And so I think that's why he's saying what he's saying. And I think his end goal is to have a Bitcoin financial institution, and he will lend and earn yield on his Bitcoin. So Terrence or BJ, if you have anything you want to, if you saw the article or the interview and you want to comment, please go ahead.
BJ, are you there?
No, I don't. I think it's just us, Terrence. So I'd like to get your thoughts on why do you think he said that? Paranoid crypto anarchist.
You know, I'm not sure why he said that, and I haven't looked at the interview yet. But you know, I did watch the one with the yield, and now he's talking, you know, about self-custody. And I think, you know, we just have to remember that he does run a public company. He does work in different circles than, you know, us running around with, you know, our little hardware wallets. And he very much is in favor of self-custody. He has many times, in fact, most of the times I've heard him, he's talked about the importance of seed words and private keys and sovereignty and keeping those and the separation of money and state. But, you know, he is really pushing forward, and he is on the forefront of institutional adoption on corporate balance sheet treasuries. And he just operates at a different level where the people he's speaking to, he probably has to have different messaging. I don't think when he said, whatever that phrase was, he said the paranoid anarchists, he was saying that there's something wrong with us in having self-custody. He was saying that in the context of the people, those people that are against having a distributed collaborative security model. Again, I didn't watch the interview, but the clip I saw seemed to be that he was criticizing people who were down on the use case for people that needed to have distributed keys or some kind of custodian, some kind of collaborative custodian. So maybe I'm wrong on that, but that's how I read it.
So that's how I read it as well. But then I think it was Ant, or I'm pretty sure it's Ant that posted it in the on a post, and he played another clip, and I had to go back and watch it twice. But I'm quoting him, Sailor. He said, "Bitcoin hardware wallet companies like to sow distrust in governments. This way, they can entice fear, and they can get your money to buy their Bitcoin wallet." And so he actually came out and said that the only reason you should have your own Bitcoin wallet is if you don't trust the government and these companies are sowing fear. So that's my pushback on that. And that's why I think he had a change in stance and maybe got a tap on the shoulder. But I see Foss, you're back up here this morning, and I know you had some comments on that.
Well, hi guys and ladies. So I missed the bulk of Larry's time on stage, and I don't know if I'd be repeating stuff. And Terrence, I think your view and my view is pretty well aligned in that, you know, he is the CEO of a publicly traded company. Okay. Now, I definitely sensed a little frustration in his responses to this subject, not just the typical sighing or deep breath that he takes, but you know, it's tough being in a chair that he's in where there are people calling him a government spook, right? And I'm not, but I see those posts, and this freedom of speech, you're allowed to believe and allowed to say this stuff, which is all healthy, but it can be frustrating as well. So maybe that was a little bit of his pushback to some of these people that are out there. And I, you know, play probabilities. Larry said it, but you know, life is about probabilities. And I sent around a tweet. I'm not trying to engagement farm as much as there's only one certainty, you know, besides death, but there's only one certainty in a probability scenario, and that's the debasement of fiat. So govern yourselves appropriately. Hardware wallets are a good thing. Bitcoin in cold storage is a good thing. The people that have been around since the days when Michael Saylor was dissing Bitcoin and saying that it was going to go the way of online gambling, there's two things there. Credit to Saylor for changing his mind. And then also, you know, that there's people that have always believed in Bitcoin. It's never been an issue. And they are the OGs that believe in 6102, which was the confiscation of gold in the United States under Roosevelt. Executive Order 6102. They believe that there's CIA operatives, not to bring up this name, but you know, I'm a fan of Jason Lowry's, but there's a lot of people that accuse Jason of being a spook, and by association would be calling me a spook as well. So I'll leave it at that. If you have any questions, I'm not a spook. Okay. I say things that I believe. What I do believe is I'm a fiat minimalist and a freedom maximalist. And no better example of what Saylor is doing in the capital markets, where I spent my career, he is absolutely teaching the capital markets, a new lesson in risk management. And the first part of his interview went in very, very in-depth as to the different parts of the capital markets, which are not efficient, that cannot buy Bitcoin, but want exposure to the price of Bitcoin. They don't necessarily want to own Bitcoin for the reasons that Bitcoin exists, but they want exposure to the price of Bitcoin and therefore do it in the capital structure of his stock and convertible bonds. And he mentioned pref shares, but he doesn't have any pref shares yet. And he mentioned high yield debt, but he retired his only high yield debt obligation because he viewed it more efficient to do it in the convertible debt markets. And he thinks that his business model warrants a multiple of net asset value, which will allow him to continue to do this. And I'll just say that I'm almost certain, not 100% certain, but I'm almost certain that his multiple to NAV and my multiple to NAV on MicroStrategy are different, which is good because I know my multiple to NAV is higher than Tomer's multiple to NAV on MicroStrategy. And some people out there say, don't even own MicroStrategy, be 100% in Bitcoin. And I'm okay with that too. So I'll leave it at that, except to say, well, leave it at that and say, everybody's different. Diversity of opinions and risk management is what is the strength of the U.S. capitalist system. And God bless America.
Well, thank you for that, Foss. We're getting to the top of the hour, so did anybody have any questions for Foss or want to address anything that we might not have covered?
Can I just add on to the Saylor thing? Like, I think it's important that we realize that, you know, his primary role is the CEO of MicroStrategy, right? So in terms of selfish interests, like, it's better for him if, you know, it's harder for us to get, you know, to hold our own Bitcoin, right? It's better for him if you have to go through an on-ramp like MicroStrategy. And I think it's just a reminder of the fact that, like, there's not going to be like a savior for anything, that any liberty, right? Like, no individual liberty is going to be really saved by any like company or these like icons that we kind of hold up. You know, they generally will get to a point where they get big enough and then they get kind of pushed down. And it doesn't mean that they completely lose any like value and they're not doing anything good for us. But they're not going to be as pure as like the individual, right? Like, so like the individual, like, it is in our interest to be purist and to be absolute, right? We saw it with when Musk bought Twitter, he was very much free speech absolutist. And then, you know, as time went on, he backed off of that a little bit. It's still the best platform, or best widely used platform, I should say. You know, you can argue like Nostr or something is better. But if you're trying to reach the large audience and much of the world, then X is probably the best platform when compared to like Facebook or Instagram or something. It's just not as good as like what I as an individual or what you as an individual might do. And, you know, maybe we're just seeing the same kind of thing with Saylor right now, right? Like, he's, you know, looking out for his own interests, which is, you know, institutional, being the route, the on-ramp for Bitcoin, because that it benefits him and his company. So, you know, just keep that in mind. You know, just because he says it doesn't mean it's in your best interest. The only one that knows what's in your best interest is you. And I suggest, you know, being a freedom, was it Foss you were saying, freedom maximalist or something like that. You know, that's definitely the way to go. So.
Yeah, I agree with you, EMR. Oh, go ahead,
Foss. Can I just add? Yeah. So Coleman, and it was so well said. People need to understand, not your keys, not your coins, under any circumstance. And that also applies to MicroStrategy. Anybody who owns MicroStrategy stock and thinks that it's their Bitcoin, I would just suggest Bitcoin is truly decentralized, whereas MicroStrategy is not decentralized. There is essentially one person calling the shots, a very smart person, in my opinion, way smarter than me, but at the end of the day, his opinion is what matters, and I can go pound sand. Even if I was a large shareholder, I believe that he will do what he has to do or believes to be right, which is obviously what you want a CEO to do, because that's what you're paying them to be, is the centralized chief executive officer, which Bitcoin doesn't have one, but never think that it's your Bitcoin. And he also says that you'll never get that Bitcoin because he's never going to sell, which also implies he's never going to have to liquidate his company, at which point you assume that the debt would all get paid out of cash and other proceeds, and then the equity, which would be Bitcoin, remaining equity would be distributed to equity holders. We don't ever want that to happen. So I wish Mr. Saylor continued success in arbitraging the global capital markets. But no, when you own MicroStrategy stock, you do not own Bitcoin. And if you think you do, you need to do a whole lot more work on the difference between what Bitcoin is and what a centralized figure controlling that Bitcoin is. Okay? Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Foss. And again, you have to give, like, Bitcoiners are excellent at promoting Bitcoin and decentralized technology. And we're also excellent at tearing each other down as soon as we say something that goes outside the narrative. And so we have to check ourselves. No one's perfect in anything. And so just make sure, again, Saylor has done a phenomenal job at trying to get large institutions to understand what Bitcoin is. And if you can show me someone that did a better job than that, I'll listen. But again, you have to give them credit where credit is due. This is one interview and we're dissecting it and cutting them apart. Again, let's just kind of see how this plays out. Let's see if he continues to become his views skew to a different way. And then we can start having maybe a little bit more cause for concern. But I think for right now, you know, Bitcoin price is just kind of chopping sideways, kind of steadily going up. We're just getting frustrated. And so we're looking at someone to attack. So just remember that he's doing a good job. And again, this is one interview. Let's just see how things play out before we really start crucifying them. So those are my thoughts on this. But if anyone else has anything else that they could finish the show on, please, now's your chance to chime in.
Yeah, if I can just jump in quickly, I guess I'll try to tie up this final thought, because I think we're all kind of in agreement. Many years ago, I met a very well-known YouTuber who, on one of his podcasts, he did an episode called Being Wrong on the Internet and his personal paranoia of making a mistake on the internet in public. And the reality is, we're all going to make mistakes. We're all going to say the wrong things or say something that 6 months later we think, well, what an idiot I was. What was I thinking? And that's why I'm a little bit hesitant towards, understand the toxicity, it's joking and whatever. But guess what? Other people don't take it that way. And it's a really good way to drive people out of Bitcoin. And that's why, you know, kind of what I'm known for, you know, fighting for freedom and putting out, you know, something that gives people hope to latch on to. We could be focusing just on the hope aspect, that it's something that can bring us together, and we can make our own choices for ourselves, as opposed to attacking people for nuanced opinions, ideas, or things that they get that are incorrect. And the other thing is, Saylor is a CEO of a public company. You know, I have some family in the finance industry. When you see the types of constraints a CEO or an executive of a public company has to prevent them from doing something that is, you know, in terms of process, illegal, that will land them in jail. It's crazy what some CEOs and executives, the type of scrutiny that they're under. So you never know what people's pressure points are and what's motivating them to take a shift. But I'm willing to bet that maybe if a bunch of people didn't attack this billionaire who stuck his neck out for Bitcoin and trying to label him a spook like they've done to me and others, maybe he would be a little bit less motivated
to push back and getting tired, because I've also gotten the thousands of tweets, the FUs, screw yous, for what I do. All I did is try to get our diapers off our faces. So let him have his opinion. It is what it is. We disagree, but let's focus on the good things that bring us together around the attributes of Bitcoin. Just my thoughts.
Yeah, thank you, BJ. And that's a perfect way to end this discussion today, is focus on the good things, focus on the positives, and show people what Bitcoin can do for a positive. Don't focus on the negative. And I'm just going to direct you all to what we're doing with Operation Gabriel. That's 100% Bitcoin. It's 100% led by Bitcoiners. And we are making a lasting impression on every single person that we come into contact with, to the other volunteers, the other government agencies that are in the area. And to all the people that are relying on us for help, they're not going to forget this. And so let's make sure that we point people in that direction. So that's it. That's today's show. I want to thank everybody who came on and listened, everybody in the audience, everybody who had to just tune on the background so they didn't have to listen to the voices in their head, everybody that joined the panel, BJ, Terrence, Hunter, Larry, Foss, Sam, Joe, Tomer, Eomar, Wade, AC, and of course, Jacob, for doing everything in the background. I really appreciate it, all you guys. This was an amazing show. I'm definitely going to go back and listen to this one again this afternoon. Join us tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. We will be back with a Bitcoin veteran video podcast. It's going to be a great show. So that'll start at 7 p.m. Eastern time. We'll be having it live stream on YouTube and X. So make sure you follow us with that. I want you all, though, to get out there today. I want you to spread a positive message with Bitcoin. Don't just focus on the Saylor interview. Go out there and show the world what Bitcoin and Bitcoiners can do in a positive way. So get out there and absolutely crush it. But do not shitcoin.